Maine Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. So, a bunch of different questions this morning I'm going to try to get to real quickly. Somebody sent me a nice message saying how much they enjoyed their petunias, and I want to talk about this because I had suggested, you know, one of the things you can do with petunias along the Gulf Coast, not every year, but most years, you can actually plant them in fall, have them all winter long, into spring and into June, and then they kind of look funky in summer. And most people, because we still think we live in Boston, has anybody heard me say this before? Sorry. Boston's a nice town. We don't live there. We live in Mobile. We live on the Gulf Coast. We live in Alabama. So petunias don't do well for us over the summer. So we don't plant them in June. We don't plant them in May. We don't plant them in April. It's the bad time to plant them. We plant them in fall because they don't like hot weather. They really don't. They don't do that well. And you'll get a lot out of them. You'll get a lot out of any variety of petunia if you plant it in fall. And there are even some perennial, virtually perennial petunias now that you can just keep all winter long. They'll bloom much of the winter, and they're really great. So and somebody said, look, I did it. It's great. It's wonderful. Thank you. I would cut them back. And depending on the variety, they may make it through the summer and bloom again this fall. It just depends. Some do. Some reseed pretty prolifically, and I've got a variety. Some of the older varieties, the Alderman is a great one, a variety called Alderman, which I like a lot, and has done real well for me in multiple places in Alabama. It's a good one to try to overwinter, and it's a good one to reseed. It will reseed pretty well, so you can keep the seeds on those and start them again. But cut it back, see what happens. Tell me what happens as it gets into fall. Chris in Pace is asking me, is it a bad time to divide strawberries? And I would say, Chris, probably it is. One of the things, because strawberries are tough on the Gulf Coast, particularly modern strawberry varieties, which are very susceptible to summer diseases. They don't like summer heat. A lot of people just start over in fall. They start fresh every fall with new plants. I think that if you're going to try to keep your plants from last year, the best thing to do is not to divide them now, but wait until what's left, until you see what's left after summer, because you may not have a lot left. Let them spread as much as they can, and divide them in late September for your production next spring, and see how that works. But I will also warn you that it may be better in along the Gulf Coast just to start fresh every year with new strawberry plants as if they were annuals, and that's how most growers do it. And it makes a lot of sense. We're working with some strawberry varieties. I'm trying to find some strawberry varieties that may perennialize, that may survive summer here in Alabama. I don't know whether I've got a couple I'm thinking about. I'm kind of working on, and we'll see. But they can be tough. They can be tough, but I don't think now is the best time to do it. If anybody wants to disagree with me about that, you let me know. Because I may be wrong, but the best philosophy is you want to start out in September with fresh plants. And so I would say if you're going to divide, you probably want to divide them so you'll have fresh plants in late September. And that's the way to do it. Dan sent me a couple of images. I want to get to these real quickly. Dan sent me an image of some beautiful plants. Beautiful, beautiful pitcher plants, and looks like, ooh, maybe even some wary eye that had bloomed, but just beautiful, beautiful pitcher plants. And he sent me a picture of something, Dan, that I'm just going to tell you is one of the nastiest things I have ever encountered. It's called Wedelia, It has a lot of names. It now has a new Latin name, and I don't even, it's a long Latin name. And honestly, I don't like the plant, so I don't want to remember the Latin name, but I'll try to memorize it. Wedelia was the old Latin name. It's sometimes called, Singapore Daisy. I've seen it called, it doesn't matter. It is a nasty plant, Wedelia. It is listed IUCN, International Union of Concern, whatever's, has basically listed it as one of the world's 100 worst, among the world's 100 worst invasive plants. It is terrible. It is horrible if it gets into the yard. Fortunately, right now, you got a sidewalk separating it, but I will tell you, it is bad when it gets in your yard. I mean, you will regret it. So, Dan, I'm going to tell you, anytime you see that Wedelia, which has the little golden little daisies on kind of evergreen foliage, get rid of it as soon as you can. It is a mess. Sorry about that, Dan. But you needed to know. I'm just going to tell you, and I don't take nasty plants lightly. I mean, it's got to be really nasty for me to get this worried about it. But, I mean, coconut grass is bad. And this has probably been actually worse in my yard than coconut grass. It's just invaded everything, and I cannot get rid of it. It came in, you know, I made a mistake. It came in some leaves that I brought into the yard. I saw it there, and I thought, well, what is this? I'm going to grow it out. And by the time I figured out what it was, it's too late. It was just eating me alive, Wedelia. Happened a number of years ago, been fighting with it ever since. It's been a big problem. A big problem. Ian is on the phone. Ian is on the board. So, Ian, do we have a caller? Terry, I'm listening. What's up? Terry, you there?
And I had a weird situation happen. I was wanting to see if you could help me. I've been trying to get in touch with you for almost a month now about this.
Yeah.
But what I've got, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I'm listening.
I'm sorry. I thought I heard something. What I've got, back in 2015, I had a row of Jubilee watermelon and another row of sugar baby watermelon. And to avoid the cross-pollination, which I thought I understood, I had like a row of butter beans or peas between them. But one day I was out there checking, and in amongst my Jubilee watermelon, I found a smaller, darker, oblong watermelon that I'm pretty sure I checked, and I think it was on the same vine that when I traced it back, it went to the same plant that on another vine had a Jubilee. So I thought I had a cross-pollination, but everything I've read, and I've talked to some people from the John Archer Agricultural Center, Mobile Botanical Gardens, and everybody I've talked to said that's not possible. And so there's a couple of people that said, well, you need to find out what the watermelon is, and I'm trying to find out if it's possible, or if I've got some sort of different watermelon that I can't find anything on the internet.
Okay, so yeah, let's talk about this. Cross-pollination is possible, but it won't show up in the watermelons you're growing this year. So it's very likely that if you have a sugar baby and a Jubilee and they're growing within 50 feet of each other, mm-hmm. even 100 feet of each other, that they're going to get cross-pollinated because the bees are going to be doing that. They do that right with melons. And so those two are going to get cross-pollinated. You won't know that they've been cross-pollinated until you take the seeds and then try to grow them out next year, and then you'll get some kind of weird hybrid that will be some kind of crazy cross between Jubilee and Sugar Baby, and no telling what it's going to be like. What happened to your melon this year is probably just, if it was indeed on the same vine as a big fruited watermelon, if it was the same vine, it's just a sport. Sometimes things like that happen. Sometimes you get smaller melons. It may have to do with the fact that it wouldn't size up right because it was already, and that happens a lot. So once you get a big watermelon, the next watermelon may be pretty small because the vine just can't support two big watermelons. That's the simplest explanation. A more complicated explanation is that you had another vine sneak in there, and maybe there was a seed that was a little bit off, and it produced that. But if you want to hold on right after this break, Terry, I'll come back, and we'll talk about it just a little bit more, okay?
Okay, I'll try to hold on.
All right.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain, rain on my face.
Yeah, there it is. Hey, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Lots of questions I'm working through. Somebody sent me a picture. It said, can you identify this for me? And it's a picture. Let's see who sent that in. Did that person leave a name? No, the person did not leave a name. Nate. No, there he is. Nate down on Dog River sent me a picture of some plants that were just now in fruit. They didn't have the bloom anymore, but it looks to me like it's a plant called Alstroemeria citizena. You ever heard of Alstroemerias? It's one of those old-fashioned plants called Lily of Peru, Peruvian lily. It has a bunch of different names. We have one that grows well around Mobile. It's kind of weedy. It was introduced. It's not a problem weed in the way some other things are a problem weed. I kind of tolerate it around my yard in Mobile, and it's Alstroemeria citizena. It has a really cool little flower. It's not super showy. It's just kind of an interesting flower, and sometimes it's nice just to have smaller, interesting flowers, right? But that's what it is. Alstroemeria, oh gosh, don't make me spell it. Alstroemeria. I'm not going to do it again. Alstroemeria. Dan is asking me, why do they call it Singapore daisy if it's a Caribbean plant? Because it's one of the world's 100 worst, most invasive plants, Dan. There you go. It's just invaded Asia in some fierce kind of way. I actually think it may be, it is Asiatic jasmine, is no question. It is an annoyance. It is a nuisance. It is a pain in the patootie. Fig vine is a pain, but I think these guys are worse. I think they're worse. So there's my thought. So Terry, let's come back, because I want to make sure I answered Terry's questions really well. Terry had this cross-pollination issue. Terry, oh shoot, well, so we missed, but Terry had a Jubilee watermelon and a Sugar Baby watermelon, and on the vine with, and we're going to just assume that this is the case, that on the vine with the Jubilee, which is a big, nice, old-fashioned watermelon, great watermelon, Jubilee, excellent watermelon. Watermelons like they used to be before they did terrible things to them, like take the seeds out of them. Delicious watermelon. But on the vine, there was a big, nice Jubilee, and then next to it, he had one that was much smaller, and he thought maybe it was cross-pollinated. But, Terry, I think it wasn't cross-pollinated. And call me back next week and scold me if I'm not hearing your question right. I don't think it was cross-pollinated. I think that oftentimes, when a watermelon produces a big watermelon, and it's nice and big and healthy, if the vine doesn't have a lot more strength, it will produce a smaller watermelon that's much smaller than the first one. And that's not a matter of cross-pollination. It's just a matter of, I give up. I've done all I can do. Now, if there was something else funky about it, if it wasn't just smaller, if it was like round instead of oblong, if it was, then I got to rethink this. So you call me back, Terry, and let's try to work on that. Let's try to work on that a little better. If I forgot any other questions that I need to get to, Dennis, I'm listening. What's up?
I was at a close friend's house in Hernandale, Mississippi, and he had some grapevines, Concord grapes. The plant looks in good health. The clusters of grapes look good, except what's happening is that seemingly at random, one or more grapes will first turn black, and then they'll shrivel up next to grapes that are perfectly fine.
Yeah, so... So Hernando is probably where you're. I'm guessing that your friend is in Hernando, which is up near Memphis, right?
Yes.
And let me say that Concord, while it's a popular thing that we all know because people in Boston grow Concord grapes, and we know more about gardening in Boston than we do in Mobile and even than in Memphis. Concord doesn't do well in the South. It is not. It does not do well in the South. It has a lot of problems, but one of them is a high susceptibility to fruit rots like black rot, and it sounds like you have some kind of botrytis black rot. It's not unusual for some of those black rots to attack just one or two fruits in a cluster, and not the other fruits in a cluster. But it can get worse, so sometimes the whole cluster will get involved. But it's probably, I believe it's a botrytis, and I'm going to just call it black rot because I think that's the name that we usually give to those kind of fruit things, fruit rots. But I'm pretty sure it's a botrytis rot. How do you deal with something like fruit rots in grapes? And can you grow grapes along the Gulf Coast? Can you grow grapes around Hernando, Mississippi? Yeah, around Memphis, I think there's a lot more options than there are along the Gulf Coast. But we both have similar problems. Both areas have similar problems. One, you want to get a grape that's free of Pierce's disease, and Concord is not. And I won't get into that, but Concord's just not a great choice. There's a bunch of others out there. Just free yourself from what you read in some book from Boston, because Concord doesn't do well from us. Look at places that sell grapes for southern climates. Look for grapes that are free of Pierce's disease, because you're going to need that in Hernando. But when you're looking for grapes that don't get black rot, that don't get botrytis, you want a grape that's a little bit more like a muscadine, because muscadines don't form big, dense clusters. And when you have a grape that forms a really dense cluster, it's going to get... Excuse me, I had to sneeze. But when you get a grape that has dense clusters, it's going to be more susceptible to black rot and botrytis and a lot of other diseases. So what you want to look for is a grape that has a more open cluster. If you're looking for pure grapes, you want one that the fruits aren't quite so dense and quite so close as they are on Concord. And there are a lot of varieties out there. And when you have that, you're much less likely to get the botrytis and the black rot, and you won't have to spray all the time. If you want to, he can spray with a copper fungicide, which is fairly safe. It really is. I mean, I don't see that there are a lot of problems with copper fungicides. I think a copper fungicide will be fairly effective against the botrytis, but he'd have to do it all the time with something like Concord. So, Dennis, I talked a lot. Did any of that make any sense?
Okay, yeah, I'll relay the information. Yeah, I had kind of an inkling that, yeah, Concord breaks don't do well around here. The other quick question I have is he has a pear tree. And they remain as hard as a rock, and they fall to the ground. And within about 12 hours, they just get soft and mushy, and they seemingly never ripen on the tree.
that's very typical. A lot of pears are that way, and a lot of the traditional southern pears are that way, and there's a lot of advantages to that. They're called hard pears, and they can be used in a lot of ways. There's something called bletting, which is when they take hard pears and they let them soften up, and you have to do that with quince and a lot of other fruit. So that's not unusual at all. He probably has something like kefir, which is a really common pear across the South. Kefir is an acquired taste. I have acquired that taste, and I actually have gotten to where I like kefirs. They can be very good, but that's not unusual at all. And it's not that they turn quickly when they hit the ground. It's that they've been softening, and as they soften, they will begin to fall. If they soften up within hours, you know, if you can eat them as soon as they hit the ground, that's better than some pears, because some pears, you have to let them sit for a month or two before they're ripe. So it's just
okay. Well, thank you very much.
Bledding.
I sure appreciate it. I'll relay the information to him then. So
yeah, and tell him to call me if he's got any other questions. He can do that even from Hernando, Mississippi.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, we talk to people from Hernando. Hey, give us a call. 251-343-0106.
Food on the table from the garden out back. Everyone working to make the land their own. Red clay cracking where the silver queen grows. Running with your cousins from yard to yard. The living was easy, but the playing was hard. Didn't have much, nothing comes for free. All you needed was your family. I am a country girl. I've been around the world, and every place I've been ain't quite nothing like.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Plant those were pretty looking beans. You know, it's we could do a whole show on just beans, and I don't think you would appreciate it in the way you should. But you should, because beans are one cool thing. Clint's got some good looking ones. We've been talking a little bit about how to plant a garden, and it's good to review it. You know, earlier today I talked with a gardener who had a problem with bacterial wilt on the tomatoes, and the problem was that and so I said, look, you need organic matter, and somebody, Josh. Josh said, look, I've helped this guy get organic matter. I know he's got it. But let me talk about how to use that organic matter in your yard. And I'm going to repeat it one more time, because we got a person who wants to talk about cracking soil, and I'm going to talk about that too. But when you're putting that organic matter on, you really want to pile it on. Now, you don't have to do this over your entire garden. But when you've got sensitive plants that are sensitive to soil-borne diseases like Pythium or Phytophthora, you don't have to pronounce those if you don't want to. I'll pronounce them for you. Pythium, Phytophthora, bacterial wilt, which is, I forgot what bacteria it is. But if you've got those kinds of diseases that are waterborne diseases that develop really well when the soil stays a little bit saturated, for those plants, tomatoes, eggplants, which get fusarium, which also seems to be a little bit water related, and peppers, for those plants I usually give a little extra effort in preparing the soil for them, so that they don't get, so I build the soil up where I've got them 4 feet high with leaves. And listen, it ain't hard. There's more leaves than I could possibly use in my neighborhood. I feel bad because I can't use them all. And all these leaves are going to the dump. I mean, other people in the neighborhood could use them, and we wouldn't have nothing would go to the dump. But you got all those leaves, and I just pile them up about 4 feet high, 4 feet wide. If you make them 5 feet high, you're doing even better. And just let it molder on down. And just where you're going to plant your tomatoes next year, just take a bed and do that. It will make all the difference. Then don't till it in. Don't turn it in. Don't do anything like that. Just plant right in the top of it. And I don't think you'll have bacterial wilt. I've never had it when I do it that way. Makes a lot of difference. But there's one other thing that's good to do to the soil, and we talked a little bit about that. So let's go to this. We got a person calling about cracking soil. Is that right? Who's that calling? All right, Will, I'm listening. What's up?
Okay, you and the first caller, I think, were talking about cracking the soil. I've never heard that term, and if I heard it correctly, it was cracking. I'm wondering what that is.
So that's good, and I hope it's a term that I've kind of tried to use. It's a little different than breaking soil. It's not tilling soil. What we're trying to do is, well, there is in virtually every soil that we encounter, that's ever been farmed, that's ever had a house put on it, that's ever had people walking across it, particularly in this climate where we get so much rainfall, there's something called a hard pan. You can call it a frangipan, a hard pan, a plow pan, but it is a very hard layer, about anywhere from about 3 inches deep to about 12 inches deep, that you just can barely get a shovel in. You can barely get a fork in. And it's in virtually every soil. It's where the soil has gotten very compacted by heavy rainfall. It happens because we have no organic matter left in our soils, and they become very vulnerable to rainfall and to walking, just walking across the soil while it's wet without organic matter in it can cause a hard pan to form. And when you have a hard pan, the roots can't penetrate it, and the water can't penetrate it, and oxygen can't penetrate it, so it's just a dead zone. And that means your roots are basically growing in 3 inches of soil sometimes on the very top. Happens to lots of lawns. And so they when it rains, the water fills everything up and they drown. And then when the rains quit, there's no reservoir of water underneath, so they dry out. And it's just the worst possible situation. So what I got, Will, is I got to figure out a way to crack the soil. I don't want to till it. Tillers just float over hard pans, and they make hard pans worse for a lot of reasons. But I want to keep the topsoil on the top because, as I've said, that's been going on for how long? I think about 400 million years, basically. The topsoil has been developing, maybe a little longer, but about 400 million years, that's the way it's been, so I don't want to change that, because plants are used to that. They want the topsoil on the top for a lot of reasons, but I just want to crack that hard pan. Farmers call it subsoiling, and they get these big John Deere tractors, and they have, like, with super horsepower, and they draw these big things to it, and you can't do that. You don't want to do that, and it causes a lot of other problems. But if you just take a garden fork, and you could, a shovel doesn't work very well because it's got a little too much surface tension. But just a garden fork with four tines, and you just wiggle it into the ground as deep as you can, and you don't even have to force it, just wiggle it, and you'll see that wiggling it down makes a lot of difference. And then just lean back on it, about 3 or 4 feet, just lean back on it. And it'll crack the soil. It'll crack that hard pan. And boom, there's it. You don't turn the soil. You don't do anything. You don't turn it upside down. You just leave it where it is. You crack the hard pan. And then you take the fork about a foot and a half to 2 feet away. You just wiggle it down again. You lean back. Boom. You crack it again. And the first time you do it, it takes a little bit of time because the soil all around it is compacted. But after you do the first, after you lever it back the first time, the second one's a lot easier, and then you get in the rhythm, and boy, you can cover a lot of ground really fast. It makes a ton of difference because you've created a new depth that plant roots can go, and that water can go, and that oxygen can go. I mean, you've may have increased the depth of your soil effectively 3, 4, 5, or 6 times just by that one action. So that's what cracking is. And that's why I call it cracking. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It really does. I always enjoy your program. Thanks for all the information.
Yeah. Good. And Will, I'll add, you know, it's if you've got problems with lawns, if I always tell people before they install a lawn, probably a lot of your problem is the hard pan and cracking that soil before putting on a lawn. It's important even there, too. It's not as hard as it sounds. We're used to doing everything with motors, and so it's really hard for us to think, oh, gosh, all I've got is a little fork here. What can that do? Well, a lot. And it's really pretty easy. It's really pretty simple. When I used to teach a garden course, I got the most, well, how do I say this? I got a person my age who looked a little elderly, who looked not real strong, not real strong at all, not something. And I just said, look, do this with the fork, and you can do it yourself. And boom, they did it. It's amazing. It works really well. David, probably can't help us today, but we're going to try to get back to the old recipe discussion. We're going to try that next week. David, that's good. I like that. I like that a lot. David and I are going to be back. David Hubble and I, we're going to talk about my controversial statements about what constitutes Cajun and Creole cuisine, what constitutes Southern cooking. I lost a caller. Give us a call back when you get a chance. Sorry if we missed you. And we'll do that. Somebody asked me, so while we're on the subject, of preparing soil, here's the next question. How do I plant peas without tilling? So there's a lot of different kinds of peas. This time of year, we want to plant southern peas, cow peas, field peas, pea-eye purple hull peas, Mississippi crowders, all of those types of peas. Those are great peas. They're great for us. It's a great time to plant them. So, you know, assuming you've broken the hard pan already, that can be pretty important. That can be pretty important. If the hard pan's been cracked, not tilled, cracked. Tilling is not going to crack it. You're going to make it worse. If you don't believe me, I'll tell you why in gory detail. But I'm just going to tell you, tilling doesn't work. You call me if you don't believe me, and we'll go into the gory detail. You just crack it, and then, you know, all you do is you take your little finger and go, and you put the seed in, there it is. I just took a little stick with a little point on the tip of it that was easy to fit into my hands, and I made it's called a dibble. You can call that a dibble, which is the old-fashioned way of planting. And I poked a little hole, and I put, not even very deep, I put my little the pidget pea, which is a traditional southern pea, pigot pea. I put it in that little hole, kind of squeezed my finger back over. That's all I did. Boom. It's going to do just fine. It's got really strong roots. It'll work its way through there. As long as that hard pan is cracked, you don't even have to worry. This is what no-till farming is about. This isn't something I invented. This is what no-till farming is about. You just drill the seed. In fact, it is the way seeds were planted for thousands of years up until maybe the 20s, 30s of the last century. It's the old-fashioned way, and it works really well. If you got any questions about that, you call me back. We'll talk about it.
How the weather in the country, how the weather down south, how the weather in the Delta, how the food tastes in your mouth.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. If I sound excited, it's because Rusty in Moss Point put the ultimate challenge out, and it just sounds like so much fun. So David Hubble and I, we're going to come back because I sort of laid down the gauntlet, whatever the term is, earlier in the show and said, look, we need to be thinking about how to use vegetables out of our own gardening to make gumbo and to make really good gumbo. And rather than waiting on the food service truck from California to tell us what we can put in our gumbos. And I will tell you, the only way to explain the Holy Trinity, which is celery, bell pepper, and bulbing onions, is to say that the food truck from Michigan and California determined that this is what we were going to put in our gumbo. It was not. These were not available in traditional Cajun and Creole cooking for a lot of reasons. So what would a gumbo look like? A 12-month gumbo. Rusty got the point. Great question. What would a 12-month gumbo look like? So, David, that's what we got to think about. And I'm already thinking about it. I'm already having a lot of fun. And I'm thinking about Aunt Joanne's gumbo and how it looked. You know, that's one kind of gumbo. I'm thinking that would work really well. It's a kind of a tomato-based. So at some points in the year, it's going to be tomato-based. You know, a roasted red pepper gumbo would be delicious, really wonderful. It would be a great thing to make a roasted red pepper gumbo. There's okra-based gumbos do all kind of interesting things, obviously. You know, and we haven't even talked about phyllo. We haven't talked about sassafras leaves, which could be, you know, it's not in and of itself enough to make a whole gumbo, but it can really change the quality and flavor of that gumbo at certain times of year. And you wouldn't do it in fall. You wouldn't do it in winter. I guess you could if you saved the phyllo powder. But sassafras leaves, they can change the quality of the gumbo. It's really interesting how they can do it. I often wonder if phyllo wasn't also a term that was used to describe things like red bay, and it's interesting. I have a feeling phyllo probably had a lot of different meanings originally, and it may have been a mixture of spices that were used in traditional Choctaw gumbos. So it would be a lot of fun. And then during winter, you got all these other greens. You know, what do you do for greens in summer? Well, we're working on that. Sweet potatoes make incredible greens. And I could, oh, you're going to freak out when I tell you this. I could see a gumbo made out of sweet potato leaves, which are actually quite delicious and could actually be quite good as a gumbo base. I could see a great gumbo base being made out of sweet potato leaves. They don't taste like sweet potatoes, but they have a very good flavor, and they're quite edible. There's lots of good greens that we don't think about because they don't sell sweet potato greens at the Publix. Well, of course they don't. How would they even? I mean, they're too dumb to even know that they're really good to eat. Lots of great ways to make gumbos, and it would be fun to think about in a sort of a 12-month gumbo. That's a really good thing. So these were our two themes this morning, sort of how to prepare this garden. And I want to go back because I think it's very good. I had two callers this morning saying, okay, you told me I couldn't till. What is this? Three callers. What is this thing you're talking about? How do you do this thing? Yeah, and so how do you do this thing? And I want to say you don't need to till. You crack the soil. You develop as much organic matter as you can, and we can talk about how to get organic matter But if you're planting peas, the peas themselves will create their own organic matter. That's the nice thing about peas. So really, for peas, you want to minimize the weeds. You just crack the soil to break up that hard pan. You're going to see that's going to leave lots of holes in the soil. You can let it settle for a day or two. You can even water it in if you like, just to settle it, or you can plant right away. Use a dibble. Use your finger. And in most soils, once you crack them, you can poke your finger in far enough. Maybe you don't want to get your finger dirty, so use a dibble. And doesn't have to be too deep. It's only about, it's just really, you're only trying to get it about an inch and a half deep, right? Inch deep. Water it in. That's what I do. And, man, they sprout like crazy. And they will grow. If that soil is cracked, if there's no hard pan, those roots are going to spread so fast over such a large area, you won't believe it. You won't believe it. Let's try. We got one caller. We have very little time, but let's try one more caller. Is it Maureen?
Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
How are you doing?
Good.
I have a quick question for you. Could you please spell the name of that weed you were describing that's very invasive? And just
briefly
what it looks like, please, so I can write it down.
Yes, ma'am. It's Weigelia, and it reminds me of Weigelia, which is an old plant, but it's not Weigelia. It's Weigelia, W-E-D-E-L-I-A.
Lost the sound. I'm sorry.
Yeah. W-E-D-E-L-I-A. Weigelia. Did you get that?
Your sound has disappeared. I'm sorry.
Weigelia.
Weigelia. Thank you. And
Weigelia.
Brief description of that, please.
And so it's got these little yellow flowers.
Yes.
On leaves that have a funny smell. The leaves have a funny smell. It's kind of an herbal chlorine-y smell. I don't know. It's like a cross between chlorine and some kind of spicy herb. But the leaves have a funny smell. The leaves are kind of have in semi-clusters of three, but it just spreads vigorously from in a mat. It doesn't get more than, say, 6 inches high. Just makes a very dense mat.
Mm-hmm. I think
so.
I that.
That's yeah. Do you? Yeah, and it can be really hard to get rid of.
Thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am.
Bye-bye.
Rusty, you have indeed created a gumbo monster. This is going to be a lot of fun. We're going to do this next week. I'm just thinking it could be a really, really great thing to do. Keith, good to hear from you. Charlie is recuperating quite well, folks. I hear from him now and again, and he's doing really well. We all hope he gets back on his feet really soon. But he's doing really well, I hear. And that's a good thing. I hope we made sense this morning. If we said anything this morning that just didn't understand it, I wish we had another hour to talk. We don't, but we'll be back next week. And you can give us a call, and let's talk about it. Let's make it work for you. Let's make this work for you. A lot of planting that needs to be done. Call me back next week. Let's get started on it. Thank you all for listening.
On your bended knees, I ain't gonna dig no more taters.